Hello, and welcome to a podcast series from iBioMD on business and biodiversity. Why is biodiversity important for business? How is business relevant for biodiversity? What is biodiversity? In this podcast, we'll be talking with brilliant and exciting people knowledgeable in this field to help make sense of the challenges and opportunities in this fascinating space. My name is Adrian Deliker. I'm a researcher at the Center for Sustainable and Inclusive Business at IMD Business School. Today, I'm honored to be talking with Dr. Christy Diner. Christy is a professor of environmental DNA at the ETH Zurich in Switzerland and an extensively published academic author. She wrote the book on best practices for use of this technology in biodiversity monitoring and is co-founder of the benefit corporation Simplex DNA with the goal of building DNA-based monitoring solutions to save life on Earth. With your decades of experience in biodiversity science, conservation, and now business, I'm really excited to welcome you today, Christy, to talk about eDNA and much more.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited about our conversation today as well.
I'm doubly excited because you're our first guest on this podcast, and you've got an impressive record in the academic space, but also, importantly, you're getting your hands dirty with your own startup, which is admirable. But I want to take a step back first. You're well-versed in general on the topic of biodiversity and nature, so I wanted to ask you specifically this question that's been bugging me myself, including in setting up this podcast. Should we be talking about biodiversity or nature? How would you explain the difference between the two? And should business even bother with understanding biodiversity, or should we just stick with nature?
Yeah, I think that's a great question to start with. One way to think about it is nature is more inclusive. Biodiversity is a subset of nature, if you want to think about it that way. Nature includes our climate system. Nature includes our water system. I'm a biologist, so I think about those things as not being living systems in the same sense that biodiversity is a living system. So this is all the things with a heartbeat, all the various ways that life lives on the planet. And those are the components of biodiversity that are really important. And they sum up into their own sort of levels, right? You have the whole complexity of everything working all together. So that's a community or an ecosystem. And then you have the species that compose that community. And then you have within each species its own genetic makeup that contributes to how it functions and what it does. So those levels of biodiversity are also really important to understand. Now, when it comes to business, yeah, I think it's important to just know that when you say nature, you're being more inclusive of other processes besides species or communities or ecosystems. And I think it's okay to talk about one or the other, but they are not synonyms.
Right. And so today, when business has its own agenda, maybe geopolitically oriented, and we're throwing these topics at them, climate change, biodiversity, is it fair to say that maybe nature is a good overall heading, or is it helpful to compartmentalize so that each bit is easier to chew, so to speak?
Yeah, I think it's important to know the difference between climate and biodiversity. They are, of course, connected and interconnected and are dependent and interdependent on each other. But I think nature is something that's less politicized, if you will. We can say the word nature and you have some association to that. Biodiversity is kind of a jargon. It's a term that, for better or worse, more or less a scientist came up with, a conservation scientist, right? And so, you know, it has that connotation to it. And so I think, you know, saying nature when you're really talking about biodiversity isn't wrong. It's just important to know that it's an inclusive way to get people to associate no matter what part of the environment or like Earth system they're thinking about. Yeah.
All right. So let's dive in the science. You're an authority on what's called eDNA, environmental DNA. You've published an impressive amount on this topic. And this has been going on for many years. eDNA is now coming up a little bit more as a popular way, let's say, to monitor biodiversity. Can you tell us a bit more about this technology, how it works, and what problems it seeks to solve?
Yeah, so I start with kind of how I came to it, which is I was studying very remote lake systems high up in the mountains. And the types of technology in ways I had at my fingertips when I was doing my studies as a PhD, were to bring up nets and alcohol and collection jars and to kill everything and put it in my backpack and carry it for kilometers or miles and then go back to a lab and look under a microscope. And that system didn't really work for the environment I wanted to be in. And being a sort of, let's say, American with my CSI kind of background knowledge, thinking, okay, well, I have DNA. My DNA is being put into the places where I am. Somebody could say I've been in a room by the DNA I leave behind. Shouldn't that be true for every species? And so I started thinking about, well, wouldn't that change the way we could detect and monitor what's living in a place? And so around this time, I was with my backpack. So I also thought, well, why don't I just filter the water onto a little piece of paper and then take that back? Wouldn't that be nice? It would be super lightweight. It would be fast. It would be efficient. And then sort through all that DNA and try to see what's living in a place. And that idea I had was not unique. There was several scientists around the globe around the same time also having a similar idea. And that was sort of, let's say, impetus or the beginning of the field, which was, can we do this? So for the better part of the last 10 years, we've been amassing an incredible evidence that yes, we can do this. We can do it for bats. We can do it for whales. We can do it for bacteria. We can do it actually for every branch of the tree of life. And that's incredible. So now it's all about not can we do it, but how do we do this and make it accurate and with precision and repeatable? And that's where we start to move into how people want to use it today, which is that can we reliably take a water sample or soil sample, gather all the sequences in there, and then be able to use that as a measure of what life is there and how, let's say, healthy that environment might be. And that's where we're really seeing scaling effects. We're seeing it roll out all over the world in dramatic ways and not so dramatic ways. And I think the value of this is that it simplifies the process from time and cost, but also who can participate. So to be able to filter water is a much more simple task than collecting insects and, you know, using specialized equipment to capture something or having the knowledge to look at a bird or a plant and know what it is only by looking at it. And so that's where it's really a niche. It's fulfilling a way to for non-experts and non-specialists to participate in creating information about biodiversity. But it's also still a lot of technical aspects that happen in the laboratory. So we analyze these with modern genetic technologies. And this is a nice partnership, let's say.
What kind of information on the ecosystem does eDNA give you, and how far of a reach does a sample in a freshwater go?
Yeah, if we take freshwater, for example, if I take a water sample in a river, that water actually has been flowing through a landscape. And even though I take water at a specific point, the DNA that arrives to that point can actually come from quite a bit upstream, you know, having gone through a forest and then through a grassland or something like that. And you actually get a much more, let's say, richer information from that sample because it's already been summarized over a larger area. So one aspect of that is you have less effort to get more information than you would with conventional methods, where you have to go out to every single one of those points across that whole landscape to get that information. Now, what value is in that? Well, all life is DNA based. So we can look at those DNA sequences, and really the process to pull out the DNA is not different depending on the species. DNA is DNA. And so the chemistry of that is easy. And we can get bacteria, we can get fungi, we can get mammals, we can get humans if we want to get into that. So there is all kinds of information hidden in that sample. And then the way we process it in the laboratory allows us to look at only a specific part of it. And therefore, it's incredibly powerful. But its limitations are more on, I would say, how you process it to bias it towards different parts that you might be interested in, or how you sample it. And then, you know, it really changes if you're in a lake or a river, like I talked about. There's different ways that water moves in the landscape, and that has an implication on what it means and what you can say about it. Now, we can arrive at these sequences, and we put names on the sequences through matching that sequence to a database where the sequence already is there with a species name. And then we can say what species are there. We can sum that up to functions of those species. So once we have a taxonomic name, so a name of a species, then we have all the information that comes with that name that we can then interpret and build a much more rich, let's say, interpretation of what it means to have those species in that place.
There's a lot of new tech involved in monitoring biodiversity, of which DNA is a key actor, but there are others like echoacoustics and imaging. How does eDNA compare to those other methods? What are its sort of competitive advantages and maybe disadvantages as well?
So acoustics or sound or images, these require that it makes a sound or that it's visible enough with the types of images we can take. So it can't be too small, right? That's where eDNA complements really well. So if it's not making sound or it's too small to capture with an iPhone or something, then it really complements those species that just don't have those characteristics. So then we get into the world of the small, which is actually what really runs our Earth systems, in the sense that they're the ones that are producing energy, for example. So the things that photosynthesize, especially in the water, like algae and other kinds of species that are really important for ecosystems and their functioning. So that's one aspect that's very complementary, meaning that eDNA is the only one that will get us that information. It is also very valuable to have multiple ways you measure something, because then you gain verification. So if you have somebody who is an expert in birds and can go out and identify all the birds, you have to rely on their ability to document that. You can't really digitize somebody's brain. And so how do you prove that? How do you verify that that was correct? Well, if you have another way that you can do that with DNA or with sound, then you create these data sets that allow you to, you know, have more precision and understanding that what you've measured is correct. What we see with eDNA over the last 10 years is we've gone out and done these other methods along taking eDNA at the same time. And we figured out there are limitations for eDNA. There are just some species that we do not detect well with eDNA. And there's a lot of different reasons for that. And then there's some where it really overlaps. One where we get a win-win is really with fish. Lots of things in the water are hard to measure just because we don't live in the water and we don't observe water in the same way. And the way we conventionally monitor fish is actually really invasive. So we do things like electroshocking. So we're using electricity to shock the fish and they float up and we catch them. That's a pretty invasive way to go and say, okay, what's living in this place? And we found that, you know, when this not that many species of fish are in a location, eDNA is actually a perfect replacement to monitor if they're there.
How much market share, if we want to talk in business terms, how much market share do you think eDNA can have in terms of biodiversity monitoring?
I think certainly when we talk about the small world, it has 100% of the market. And when I'm talking about bacteria or pathogens, a lot of this is the only method. And a lot of the methodology really goes back much further than, you know, sort of the coined term of environmental DNA in terms of measuring bacteria diversity. But where I think it will replace is situations like I described with fish, when the conventional method is so invasive that it doesn't make sense if you're trying to conserve a population. Insects are another great example. Most of our methods there, we actually kill them in order to know they're there. And there's lots of arguments, pros and cons, like, yeah, insect populations are big and it wouldn't matter if you kill 100 of them. But there's ethical concerns that might drive a bigger market share just because we don't want to do those types of methods anymore. And I think that it will often complement, if not replace. And so I think there's a large portion of the market that can benefit by using this one. It also scales in a different way than all other tech. So on a per record basis, it is the cheapest method by far, even snapping a picture when we talk about sequencing and how cheap it is.
So how cheap is it?
I think it's about 1/1,000,000th of the cost of an image, right? Meaning that, you know, when we pull hundreds of samples together and we can generate sequence, the cost of that is fixed. So you can sequence one sample and it has the same cost as if you sequence 1,000. And so we can pull 1,000 samples together and the cost per record just keeps going down and down and down. And we are nowhere near the limit of how cheap it is to generate those sequences. The problem is we have to get 1,000 or 10,000 samples all at once. So the sourcing of getting the samples is actually where the cost is and not on the sequencing side. So producing the data is fast and cheap. For example, I just ran a global project where we have over 400 lakes in the world that were sampled. It took a year and a half to organize and get the samples and have everything shipped to us, and we generated the data in 3 weeks. So that's the time and cost in terms of salaries and the ways that we can save a lot there.
You mentioned ethical concerns. How about concerns maybe around DNA and human activity or monitoring? Some states or actors, businesses might have some nefarious ideas around using DNA or eDNA to maybe monitor human populations. Is that a thing, or is that overblown?
Yes, this is definitely something that we should have a broader conversation about as a society. What are the ethical boundaries we want to draw around this? The way that we currently use environmental DNA, the information that you can derive from the fragment of DNA that we look at is there's human there. You can't really say much else. While there are unique sequences to specific, mostly indigenous populations in the world that you could differentiate from my sequence and theirs, and it wouldn't just be we're both humans, that is, I think, where we have to start to understand what we do with the management of the data. What is public? What is removed? What is privacy and ways to protect that privacy? But again, in this sense, you're saying humans are there. Can we track individuals yet? No, the technology is not there. It doesn't mean it won't exist. So I think that that's a good and valid reason why we should have this, start having this conversation now to set up what is the way to move forward. I think when it comes to other species, though, I think, yes, there's also concerns about using this type of data for poaching or tracking trafficked species. And as scientists, we have ways that we already manage and deal with that data. We don't provide exact geolocations for that. We don't allow the sort of information to be presented in a way that somebody could use it for tracking other species. But I still think there's some concerns there as well.
You're a professor at a very prestigious university in Switzerland, ETH. You're well published on this topic. I assume your job security is pretty strong, but you took the step of founding your own company. What motivated you to do this? How are things going?
So I was at ETH as a ERC. So I had a European Research Council grant to build my research program for 5 years. But at the beginning of that, it was always planned that I was starting this company and transitioning into the company after I finished, which is next month. I'm excited. So as of March 1st, I'll be full-time in Simplex DNA and putting my full weight behind that. A lot of my research is already with partners like conservation organizations or governments who clearly want to monitor biodiversity. I think the space that's very hard to crack or open up is the corporate world and understanding their constraints or concerns or interest in wanting to understand their own impact on biodiversity. And so I think as a startup, for us, we want to support governments and conservation organizations. But the bigger piece in here is how do we actually have the private sector also caring about what they're doing and what are the metrics they need and how do we build a solution that really helps make better decisions when it comes to business? And I think as a startup, it's hard because we're speaking different languages coming from science and this new monitoring tech and how it can play a role. But we've learned a lot over the last years. And I think the most important gap is really the interpretation of the data. I think we will always remain on the data supply side, so less on the interpretation, because there's lots of ways it needs to be interpreted. And I think there's a lot of expertise and amazing startups out there doing that, filling that gap. And so it's more about making sure high quality, useful data is flowing into those types of platforms.
So who's your typical, or you want to be your typical client? Are they corporates? I assume the government is also interested in the technology and in your services and in the data, and maybe nonprofits or academics.
All of those are current customers of ours. Where there's an interesting scenario here is we can produce data, let's say, on demand in a specific way for a specific customer. But we also know how to make the data for anybody. And so it's kind of a chicken or egg. What would a world look like if you already had the data and you could just access it in a database versus making it only when somebody needs it? What we face in biodiversity often is people want data from 5 years ago after an impact has happened to quantify what is the impact. Right? And sometimes you don't have that data. And so what we're working on is a solution that's actually providing the data in an open source way, not open use necessarily, but open source way that you can say, okay, yeah, eDNA is valuable. Look at all this data I can use, and then sort of wrap it into, you know, some kind of reporting standard or regulation you might be required to meet. Those are the ways that we can think about shifting the market. So rather than us providing services to make data, we're actually giving you the data and then packaging it in a way that makes sense.
What do you think are some of the main motivations for corporates to talk with you? Do you think they're feeling there's incoming regulation? Do they want to just do good? Are they trying to attract a green customer? Do you have any insight on that dynamic?
I have some. I would say most corporates are realizing they need to do something. Some have gone down the road of quantifying the risk they have when it comes to biodiversity. Very few, I think, have on the ground like plans. We're implementing this, we're monitoring this, we know we want to capture these five, you know, elements of biodiversity. That part, I think, is where we're far from that. And that's where I think the public-private sector needs to work together to figure out what are the realistic regulations, what are the policies that are coming into play that are important. The big one looming, of course, is the Kunming-Montreal Agreement, which is stating that by 2030, we actually have to report, or corporations need to report on their impact on biodiversity. So we need to build systems in the next 5 years that allow corporates to meet that regulation that's going to come into play.
I want to take this moment to congratulate you. You won a next prize.
Yes.
And I think you won a sizable amount of money, which I'm interested in also how you're raising money and how does venture capital look at a firm like Simplex DNA? What do they find exciting and where do you think they're putting their money?
Yeah, ooh, if I knew that, I think I would be already having investors. But there is a need for venture capitalism in this space. It's an interesting one. It's a complex one. I think it's much harder for a VC model to work because it is a public good. I can't name any public good that is funded by VCs. But I think that there are business models that make sense for investment. I could see corporate VCs investing in nature tech because they are going to have to measure it and quantify it and understand their risk to improve their businesses. So there might be sort of a subset of VCs out there that find a good match with nature tech. I can't say on the top of my head which ones are leading in that space. And if you're listening, come talk to me.
Yes, we'll make sure all your contacts are available. Where do you see the role of AI in nature conservation and metrics, maybe predictive project management? Where do you see this sort of the entry points, the future of it? and the advantages of it?
There's probably disadvantages too that I could mention.
Please elaborate.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think AI in a broad sense is going to be incredibly valuable. I think any model trained to be used is going to have the downside of the fact that we just don't know a lot about life on Earth. And so all models are wrong and some will be useful, right? There's this famous quote. And I think in terms of actionable next steps for AI, what is unique in eDNA data is that it's very complex. And most of the sequences we cannot put a name on. There are things not even described by science. They've never been measured. But we have a record of their existence. And so I think when you throw this really complex data that we have no other way of making sense at an AI, you know, sort of machine learning, neural network models, you know, all these kinds of ways that we could try to package that into an understanding of what's happening, I think there's a lot of value there. Anytime you have a super complex data where you know nothing, it will be useful to at least generate hypotheses about what might be valuable. And then if you are taking other really complex systems like climate models and consumer supply chains, and you throw those all together, I think we are going to be in a place of massive learning on a scale that we can't even imagine. And if you throw in quantum computing in that, then it's going to be a whole new place and realm of understanding that we'll live in. So those are my, like, you know, pie in the sky kind of dreams and ideas that it would be useful. There's ways we can use it now already. And I think there's a big spectrum in between there. I think where we have to be careful is, you know, you train these models on data, and data is really biased when it comes to biodiversity. We have such huge gaps in major places in the world where most of the biodiversity is. And we have to be cognizant of that, just like we do with recognition or any of the other algorithms that have been trained out there, that we have to be very clear that there can be a lot of, let's say, misuse of it in a way that could be detrimental to its advancement.
Where is most of the data collected and where is it lacking most?
Most data is from 10 countries, and most of that is in the, you know, northern hemisphere, certainly GDP-rich countries. And that is not where biodiversity is, right? Biodiversity is in the tropics. It's in the rainforests of the world. And so we have a real bias in terms of the geographic distribution. The other bias we have is even in the places where we've measured the most, we don't have temporal information. So it'll be like somebody looked at something 10 years ago and there's no more information since. And so the aspect of monitoring repeated measures through time is terrible everywhere and lacking just any information is in places where we have the need and the, let's say, the poorest communities of the world.
You co-founded a startup, which I take to mean that you're hopeful about the future. I don't think anybody would, in their right mind, would launch a startup if they weren't hopeful or at least future-oriented. What gives you hope in this space in the future? What are you looking for?
Yeah, I'm impressed, actually, with the corporate world. There are some real positive signals out there, and I have a fun interpretation of that because I'm an ecologist. So I've been trained to think about systems and life systems and how species interact. And we have this thing called a food chain, which is, you know, just who eats who and who depends on who. And when we think about the corporate world, there are systems or species or businesses that depend on other businesses, right? And so there is a corporate food chain out there, if you will. And one of the things we know in ecology is called a trophic cascade. So when there's not enough food for a predator to eat, what happens to the predator? The population crashes and may go extinct. So there are industries out there in the corporate world that are dependent on other industries functioning. They are their food. And they see that they can no longer find food, right? And so we talk about the reinsurance companies. So Swiss Re is a big one. We talk about banks, which rely on people putting money into their bank to do stuff with their money, right? And so you see that there's these links, and they are pushing big time the risk that we have in the system due to biodiversity. And I had the honor to stand next to Sergio from UBS last year at WEF, and he is saying things that I say as a biodiversity scientist and their chief sustainability officer also. And to hear them say the things that I have understood for 20 years is incredible. And so for me, this is system correction happening. The big predators in the system, if you will, are realizing what we're facing, and they know what they need to do. They need to invest in the bottom of that food chain so that their food is produced. And that means you see things like coming from Swiss Re, like here's a habitat biodiversity intactness index, and insurance companies should be using this to help them prioritize insurable markets. You know, and so that's the kind of corrections we're starting to see, and it's really exciting. So that's what gives me hope. And where we play a role in this is providing accurate data on real time, you know, near real time, what's going on with the status of biodiversity in the world. And I think the better and the higher quality that data is, and matching that with all our other ways that we can measure biodiversity, we can put those things together and make a real difference in the trajectory of where we're going.
Thank you so much, Christy, for joining and for this great conversation. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. It was my honor.